Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin voters approved changes to the state's cash bail system in last week's election. We'll find out what impact the state constitutional amendments could have. First, how healthy is your community? The University of Wisconsin's Population Health Institute has released their annual county health rankings and roadmaps for every county across the country. Here in Wisconsin, the so-called WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington, all ranked in the top five of the state's healthiest counties. Neighboring those suburban counties, Milwaukee County ended up near the bottom of the list, ranked 70th out of 72 counties. How can the health outcomes for communities so close to each other end up so far apart? More than 80 factors were considered in this year's county health rankings. And here's one that might surprise you. Our civic life can have big health impacts. You can find a link to this year's report on our website. Go to WPR.org/Central Time. And you can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Are there things that make your community a healthy, happy place to live? What are they? What could your community do to improve health outcomes? What would you like to see happen to increase social and economic opportunities for others, which, as we'll find out, is a factor in our well-being? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sherry Johnson is director of the UW Population Health Institute and the principal investigator of the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps that's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Sherry is also a professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Sherry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, a lot of factors go into this report. Can you give us the big picture? What are you hoping we can learn from this county-by-county health report?
Correct. So nearly every year in the last sort of 12 years, we've taken an annual look at the health of nearly every county in the United States. And we use a model of health that helps us understand that health is determined by a lot of factors, things like the social and economic conditions that we live in, the physical environment, our access to clinical care or health services, and our health behaviors. And so we use that model of health to spark conversations in local communities, to help local communities really dig into their data to try to look at where they have strengths in some of those areas and where there's room for improvement. And this year we focused on civic health, and we thought about it in two ways. We thought about it in terms of civic infrastructure, which includes the places where we can gather, learn about each other, understand the democratic process, as well as civic participation. And that includes the way that we participate in community life, things like volunteering and mentoring, but also voting and having a say-so in policy.
And I want to spend some time on that civic infrastructure and its impact on our health. I want to look first, though, at one thing that seems to be consistent with past versions of this report, a continuing racial disparity when it comes to health outcomes. And that might be from one county to another, but the report points out even in a county like a Dane County that looks pretty good on the report, you're still seeing those disparities there. Can you talk about what you found and the persistence of these disparities over the years?
Yep. So one of the new features this year that you can take a look at in the county snapshot is a bit of a historical descriptor statement. It includes a link to an opportunity to learn about the Native nations that lived on the land of that county. And it also includes information about counties that experienced one particular type of policy, redlining, that has a long arc of impact in terms of the social and economic resources that are available in certain communities and promote health, and that were intentionally made unavailable in other communities and have detracted from health. So that's a really important addition to understanding why things are the way they are and why groups of people in different places in different counties across our state have not had the opportunity to experience the same quality of health or length of life because of historical policy and practice like redlining.
Can you talk a little more about the practical impacts of something like redlining, a big tool in maintaining segregation in a lot of Wisconsin communities? What are some of the specific health impacts of that here in 2023?
Right. So if you think about the way that redlining allowed some people to purchase homes and to build equity in those homes and then have both economic cushion to respond to any sort of financial shocks that they might experience, but also to invest in the future of their families and communities by having the resources available for example, higher education or home purchases for future generations. So there's a generational impact that wealth building has had, and that generational impact has been different for those that were discriminated against through federal policy that deemed some neighborhoods unworthy of investment, and the people that lived in those neighborhoods then did not experience the same opportunity as those who were able to get those federal loans. So also think about the way that residential segregation is linked to school segregation and segregation through a more modern practice of digital redlining, where many of those same neighborhoods that were redlined through federal policy now have less access to digital broadband services, which are a key part of the civic infrastructure that we lift up in this year's report as well.
Talking to Sherry Johnson, director of the UW Population Health Institute and principal investigator of the report we're talking about. It's called the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Report. It goes county by county in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes your community a healthier place to live or a less healthy place to live? And we're going to get into this idea of civic infrastructure. Now, think about things like parks in your community, libraries, community centers for seniors or teens or everybody in between. Do you have those? Do you wish you have those? How big a part of your life are they if you do have them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sherry, can you talk a little more about this idea of civic infrastructure? I gave a couple tastes of what that might mean. What were you looking at in this report?
Right. So you did name some of the key places that we focused in on. So places like libraries and parks that can foster social connection, as well as policies such as automatic voter registration and early in-person voting that allow people to engage. So it's both the places that we invest in, that we allocate our shared resources to, and the policies that form an infrastructure that can make participation in decision-making processes easy and available to as many people as possible.
Now, people might hear that and say, hey, wait a minute. I thought this was a health report. What's the civics doing here? What is the civics? Can you draw the line between those civic foundations and policies and the well-being of a community?
Right. So those infrastructure elements are the places that we know also correlate to resources that are necessary for health. So things like adequately funded schools and parks and broadband internet are part of the civic infrastructure. Broadband internet became really important during the pandemic for a number of things, whether it was telehealth access or access to social benefits that became available to help people meet their basic needs. When you think about parks, you can think about access to exercise opportunities, access to gather with neighbors and even new people that you haven't met yet to understand each other's perspectives and come to some shared understanding of priorities for resource allocation. So there are a lot of different ways that civic infrastructure can create the places and strategies for us to come to some agreement about how we construct the conditions that are necessary for good health.
In the report, you give some case studies of communities that, might have had a difficult civic infrastructure situation, but decided they didn't have to live with that and made some changes. One you looked at was Greenville County, home to Greenville, South Carolina. Can you talk about what you learned from that experience?
Yeah, that was a place where there was a lot of grassroots organizing around transportation barriers. And they gathered many local residents to help shine a light on the importance of equitable transportation, and were able to see some substantial investment in transportation to particularly neighborhoods that, again, had been negatively impacted by previous policy, and improved the county public transportation overall. So local advocates who were called green shirts were instrumental in collecting input and signatures from bus riders and lifted up those concerns to local leaders about the need for enhanced services. And they ultimately got an $11 million grant for a new maintenance facility. They got electronic payments instead of cash payments that folks weren't even getting their change back. They got expanded hours and new routes to underserved areas. So that link from civic participation, so people who are closest to the problem of inadequate transportation, collecting data on the bus from other people, and then using that data and their own personal experience to advocate for a better system that is beneficial to the whole county.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Madison. Mark, hello.
Hello. I'm interested. All these health metrics are interconnected, as your guest has pointed out. Is there one metric that a community focused on would have the most impact on the others?
Oh, interesting question, Mark. Is there one particular aspect here that you know, might be the low-hanging fruit, that big investment that's going to pay off the most, Sherry?
It is a great question, and we actually have more than 90 measures in the county snapshot for local change makers to take a look at, to understand, and then to really make those local decisions together about what makes the most sense. So the short answer would be no, there isn't one measure that we think all communities should focus on. You can look at your data, you can disaggregate it, meaning break it up by different racial and ethnic groups to better understand if everybody is having the same opportunities and outcomes. You can think about, you know, where you have the most shared priorities and start there. So there's a lot of ways I think that people can use the data for action. And that's really what we hope, that this is a spark of a conversation, and it's a public good resource that people can use to make change.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sherry Johnson, director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, principal investigator of the report we're talking about titled County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. She's with us to talk about this year's rankings for Wisconsin counties and the many factors that go into building healthy communities. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this report, this idea of civic infrastructure? When you look around you at your own community, do you see a lot of that? Are there parks where people get together and you can meet your neighbors? Are there libraries, community centers, schools that let people have public meetings, things like that, where you can go and feel connected to your community? Do you wish you had more of that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sherry Johnson, director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. We're talking about this year's County Health Rankings and Roadmaps report and the many variables that go into creating healthy communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see health disparities within your community? What should your local government say or local leaders be doing to improve health outcomes? And this report focuses on civic life, civic infrastructure. Do you feel like you have that in your town? Places where people gather, maybe people from different backgrounds. Have you tried to make a change in your community? Who did you reach out to? How did it work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Sherry, you mentioned change makers in communities. Mm-hmm. I think you're hoping that your report gets used by people who want to make change. Who are you looking at when it comes to people, your audience for the report, and what they're going to do with it?
Yes. So we hope that change makers from across the spectrum take a look at the report. So that means grassroots organizers who are working on making sure that everyone who's eligible to vote can vote. That means elected officials who are responsible for making policy for all of us in Wisconsin. It means organizational and institutional leaders, across sectors. So the healthcare sector, but also the housing sector, the governmental public health workforce. For example, the American Medical Association has declared recently that voting is an important determinant of health. The American Public Health Association has made similar declaration. The Healthy People 2030 has included voting as a research objective. So there are a number of organizations that are rallying around this concept of civic participation and the many ways that we can take steps together to improve civic participation and ultimately improve how long and how well we live.
I want to look at another community you highlighted. This one, Cornelius, Oregon, and how Latino groups there have helped to improve their overall civic health. What did you see there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cornelius was a great story. So this is a small suburb outside of Portland where a growing Latino population was not yet fully engaged in the decision-making process. And so local leaders in community organizations, as well as in government, got together to try to expand their engagement and used a number of strategies and have seen some really great outcomes. So now more than 50% of the commissions and boards in that community have Latino representation. There was a very concrete outcome in terms of them working together to create a new housing structure for seniors that also includes a library on the first floor. And that allows the school children from a nearby school to interact with seniors and with bilingual librarians. So they've really taken this concept of civic participation, leading to the resourcing of civic infrastructure and really expanding the voices of people in the community who have input into how we use our shared resources. It's a great story.
And as I'm reading the story, it sounds like, you know, some people in local government and some people with local Latino groups work together. They form this partnership. Now, if somebody is a local leader or a change maker and says, gosh, we're doing all this work here, but there is a part of our community that isn't at the table. What do you recommend for them to help reach out and start making those connections?
Right. I think it's starting with understanding who are the leaders in that community, that there are local leaders at the grassroots level that are part of many of the communities that have not had a fair seat at the table. So it's reaching out to those leaders, being present in their meetings and social activities to really get to know them and to understand their priorities and perspectives. And then being systematic, I think the way that Cornelius was in terms of building the opportunity for participation through things like dual language town hall meetings and dual language surveying that really has made measurable change in that community.
We've got a link to the report at WPR.org/Central Time. People can go there and look at their own county or any county they're interested in. Can you give some guidelines, some suggestions for people who want to take this for a spin, see what they can learn from it and see what they can do with it?
Yeah, so please go to countyhealthrankings.org to take a look at your county snapshot. You just type in either your zip code or your county name, and you'll see an array of data that you can also look at in comparison to other counties in Wisconsin, as well as national rates. And then I want to draw attention to something called What Works for Health, which is part of our website, and it's a goldmine of more than 400 strategies and programs that have been analyzed for levels of effectiveness. So when you want to get to the take action part, you can go to What Works for Health and find evidence-informed strategies, things like expanding civic education for our K-12 students so that they're fully prepared to participate and lead our democracy going forward. There are things like voter turnout initiatives that can help expand representation in the democratic process. And so take a look at What Works for Health if you are interested in strategies that have been analyzed and reviewed for effectiveness. And the website is countyhealthrankings.org.
And I'm guessing research of this scale gives a lot of answers, but probably also raises a lot of questions. Sherry, what top questions on your mind now coming out of this report process?
So every year we ask ourselves, what is missing? What else do we need to add to help local communities take their work a step forward? So this year's focus on civic health, including civic infrastructure and civic participation, was part of that process of asking ourselves what else is needed. And we plan to continue to dig deeper into what often are called those more upstream drivers of health. So looking away from personal behaviors, understanding that personal behaviors are nested in a set of conditions that are created by our social and political processes. How do we help people understand that, measure it, improve it is sort of the path that we're on.
Sherry, thanks for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Sherry Johnson, director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, principal investigator of the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Report, and a professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She joined us today with a look at this year's report, how the health of Wisconsin's counties measures up. You can find a link to that report and check out what's going on in your neck of the woods. We've got a link at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, the cash bail system in Wisconsin is changing after voters passed referendums last week. A criminal law professor joins us to explain the changes and the possible impact they could have. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks finished this season with the best record in the NBA and the number one seed for the playoffs. We recap the year that was and look ahead to the postseason. Now, voters in Wisconsin approved two referendums last week that amended the state constitution when it comes to the cash bail system. The amendments focus on the conditions under which a person can be held in custody on cash bail and the factors a judge can consider in setting the bail amount. After the referendums passed, Governor Tony Evers signed onto a law that was passed by the Republican-controlled state legislature. It clarifies where and how these constitutional amendments will be applied. The bill had some bipartisan support, but opponents of the changes fear that the cash bail system will be harder on low-income offenders compared to those who can afford to pay a higher cash amount. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vote to support those amendments to the cash bail system? Why or why not? What are you hoping to see change as a result? Do you think these changes go far enough? Do you have questions about the bail system, how it works, what it's meant for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches criminal law, constitutional criminal procedures, sentencing, and corrections. Cecilia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I have read and heard, Cecilia, a lot of different reads on how big a deal these changes are. What is your take on that? How much actually changes with these now passed and signed into law?
I think we'll have to wait to see how much judges rely on these changes in law. They certainly do, however, pretty significantly expand the ability of judges to use cash bond in criminal cases.
Can you talk about the original intent of cash bonds and bail systems? My understanding was it wasn't so much about the threat a criminal suspect might have to the public. It was a threat that they might not show up for their trial.
That is correct. And I think there's a lot of public confusion on this point. Often when people want to see cash bond used in criminal cases, what they really mean is that they think people shouldn't be released pre-trial, that they have safety concerns about people who aren't yet convicted being in the community while they're waiting to go to trial and be convicted or acquitted from criminal charges. But because people who have been charged with crimes haven't been found guilty yet of committing a crime, we presume them to be innocent. And innocent people don't get to be detained except in very special circumstances. We do have a law in Wisconsin, like most states, that under certain circumstances says that people can be held without any kind of bond whatsoever. However, most people charged with most crimes are supposed to be released into the community. And what we can do is have conditions that we place on them that are designed to keep people reasonably safe. Cash bond is one of those conditions that can be imposed, but the way it works usually is that it's supposed to incentivize people's appearance in court to make sure that they actually do show up and let the state make its case against them. And so for that reason, if people don't show up and they've been required to pay cash, they'll forfeit it. That's the way it's supposed to work. It's not supposed to, however, be set in an amount that people couldn't reasonably pay.
One concern that people have been raising for years is if you rely on cash bond, it could create, in effect, a two-tier justice system. An offender without lots of money stays in jail until their trial. A person with sufficient amount of money can walk free until their trial. How big a concern do you see that being?
That is a real concern, and there is good research that suggests that, in fact, that is what happens. Although the law requires that bail be set in reasonable amounts, reasonable is a broad term. And for many people, even a small or modest amount of cash bond may be more than they're able to come up with. The majority of people who are processed by the criminal system are people of very little financial means. And as a result, even modest cash bond amounts may be too much and people will sit detained. We know that when people are detained, all sorts of things happen. They can lose their jobs and their homes. They're more likely to plead guilty, not just because of the charges against them, but because it's harder often to develop facts to use in one's defense and for other reasons as well. And so it is a real concern that people who have money and can post bond are often at an advantage throughout the criminal process compared to those who can't. That can create inequity and also create other concerns too about who it is that we release and under what conditions.
Talking to Cecilia Klingel, associate professor at the UW Law School, looking at bail, cash bail in Wisconsin. Two constitutional amendments related to that issue passed last week, implementing laws signed into effect also last week. You can join in with your thoughts on that. Are you happy to see these changes? Do you have concerns about them? Do you have questions about how all this actually works in practice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you've participated in this, if you have been subject to a cash bond yourself, or you've been a victim of a crime where the perpetrator was, or you work in the system, love to hear your experience at 800-642-1234. Cecilia, the concern, part of the concern that drove this came from the Waukesha Christmas vehicle attack. The perpetrator there had been out on what people perceived to be a low bail that didn't take into account a history of violence. What do you make of that concern that if we don't take these things into account enough, we may put the public at risk?
Well, so I think a few things. One, it's always a little bit dangerous to make law based on very unusual cases. That said, it's true that we need to be attentive to public safety concerns and that it does happen in our system that sometimes people who are accused of crimes but not yet convicted have past histories and may be facing current charges that implicate the safety of individuals within the community. My concern is that the answer to that is not necessarily broadening cases in which we use cash bond, because again, cash isn't meant to detain people, but rather it would be examining that other statute that I mentioned that allows us under certain circumstances to deny release altogether and not simply make it available to those who have more means than others. That statute we haven't amended, and there have been criticisms that it is both too narrow in some ways and that it's a little bit procedurally clunky in others. And that might have been a better place to focus our reform efforts.
On a related note, one of the changes that did happen was changing a phrase from serious bodily harm to now just serious harm in assessing a bail amount, again, with that risk to the public in mind. Is that a significant change, taking out that one word, bodily, and just saying serious harm?
So it might be, and that doesn't just apply to cash, that applies to the conditions that are set. So serious bodily harm is a term that isn't defined by the statute specifically, but that some judges took to mean that they could only set conditions for people on bond when we thought that they posed a risk of injuring people to in a really serious and protracted way. Of course, we want to be attentive to other kinds of harm as well. And also, again, I keep coming back to the fact that we presume that people are innocent. We don't get to punish them before they're convicted. And so what I think the legislature was trying to do was give judges a little bit more discretion in setting all kinds of conditions, both cash and other restrictions on people's liberty, in cases where they had concerns about harm to the community, but not necessarily harm that would land someone in a hospital, for example. Now, of course, you can make that too broad and, again, restrict people's liberty in a way that's punitive, which we're not supposed to do under the law. And I think that we will, again, have to rely, as we often do in the criminal system, on the wise use of discretion by prosecutors and by judges in not setting conditions that are overly restrictive.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. Say, I was wondering if your guest could perhaps speak to the advent of the bail bonds industry and their impact on whether they would be for or against the cash bail system, the pros and cons of that. It seems to me that, you know, they may have a kind of a clear agenda in these people remaining in jail or going to jail and receiving a cash bond just because it's advantageous for a business. So maybe if you could speak to that a little bit.
Thanks for the call. And Cecilia, you know, we see in the movies those bail bondsmen, usually called bail bondsmen. We don't have that exactly here in Wisconsin, do we?
We do not. You are correct. We are one of only several states that does not permit the use of bail bondsmen. And I think that that's something we should probably be proud of because the caller is correct that there are all sorts of incentives that can enter the system when we have profit motives involved that aren't focused on kind of the core concerns of bail, which again is making sure that people show up to court in order to answer for the charges against them. One thing that we have seen here in Wisconsin without the use of bail bonds people is that when our judges do set bond, it tends to be in more modest amounts than we might see in jurisdictions where bail bonds people often will take on the role of posting bond, but then people are required to pay them usually some fraction of the full bond amount. That tends to drive up the amount that courts often set for bond. And we don't have that kind of inflation in our courts, which seems to me a good thing.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison law professor Cecilia Klingel about the state's cash bail system and how it changes after two constitutional amendments passed in last week's election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the cash bail system should work in Wisconsin? Or would you like to see something apart from that? More of a question of, okay, is it safe to have this person or in public or not? Forget the money side of it. How would you like to see that evaluated? What questions do you have for our guest about how all of this works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Cecilia Klingel. She teaches about criminal law and procedure as an associate professor in the UW Law School. With us today to explore how cash bail works in Wisconsin and how it's changing after voters approved a pair of constitutional amendments last week. Still time for you to join in with your questions, your thoughts on the outcome of those votes, your maybe experiences with that system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions for the guest. The first question is, I had the perception that up until the referendum and reading up on the referendum, the judges were allowed to take into consideration the crime and the past history of the individual who committed the crime when they set bail. And I'm wondering if the reason why I had that perception has to do with, does Wisconsin or did Wisconsin differ from other states in America because of that? And so that was the perception. I will admit, I didn't think that, I thought judges could take that into consideration, and I learned because of the referendum that that wasn't the case.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Cecilia, did judges, pre-referendum, have some of that discretion that Gary's talking about?
So they did. You weren't wrong, Gary. Here's how it worked. Before the amendment passed, there were three reasons and only three reasons why judges could choose to impose cash bond and other conditions too. One is the reason you could impose cash was if someone was going to fail to appear in court. You could impose conditions of any kind if also there was a concern about the intimidation of witnesses or that someone was going to cause serious bodily harm to someone during that pretrial period. What the amendments have done is expand the list of considerations for when you can impose conditions, including cash bond, to a broader range of circumstances. But even before the amendment, of course, judges, when deciding whether or not you were likely to intimidate witnesses or cause serious bodily harm, or even fail to appear in court, would often look at your history. So for example, a common scenario would be that if someone has a history of escape charges, then and a history of failure not to appear in court, then it would have been more likely that that person was going to receive cash bond from the very beginning. And in deciding whether the other factors had been met, someone's criminal history would also have been considered. The amendment just makes that explicit and again, sort of broadens the range of circumstances in which any kind of condition can be imposed and cash can be used.
Thanks for the call, Gary. And Cecilia, Gary wondering, in general, how does Wisconsin compare to other states in the practical use of those that discretionary power? We already talked about the bail bond system, which we don't have in Wisconsin. Anything else stand out to you notable about Wisconsin versus the rest of the country?
Well, bond is a really big topic of law reform right now. I think one thing that is notable is that our state just expanded the circumstances in which courts can impose cash bond, whereas the general trend in law reform is toward limiting the circumstances in which cash can be used. So this is a little bit against the grain of the momentum that we're seeing around the country. But again, it's an area of just great flux in the law. And I think states are experimenting broadly with different approaches to bond.
A big question, Cecilia, is does changing our cash bond system one way or another affect public safety? I'm guessing there's probably been research on that. It's probably a tough subject to research. Do we know much?
Well, I think we know a lot about little pieces, right? And the thing about crime is that it's not monolithic. Every crime is unique. There are different patterns among people who are perpetrating crime. Like misdemeanors are not the same as felony offenses. Crimes that involve interpersonal violence are not the same as crimes that are committed when people are having a mental health crisis or other complicated situational factors. And so because of that, you can't give one simple answer to the question of public safety. I think what we do know, though, is that looking at case-specific facts and making decisions about imposing conditions that are narrowly tailored to the facts in front of us is helpful in making sure that our system is both protecting our community as reasonably as we can, while also making sure that we're paying attention to people's procedural rights and that we're being fair in the way that we're deciding criminal cases and limiting the liberty of people who are accused of committing crime.
You know, it sounds like a judge might have a fair amount of discretion here. And awaiting trial, my outcome is going to be pretty different when it comes to cash bail and release if I get this judge or the one in the next county or even the one in the next courtroom. How much variability is there from one judge to the next?
I mean, decision makers matter, right? Our selection of judges matters. Our selection of prosecutors matters. And we do in the American criminal legal system rely heavily on the wise and prudent judgment, the discretion of people who have been charged with exercising authority, so prosecutors and judges in particular, and what you're charged with, even when we look at police, whether you're arrested, whether your case is referred for criminal charging, all of these things can vary depending on the decision maker who's in front of us, which is why it's really important that we have public servants who are paying attention to the law and thinking wisely about how to balance all of these competing interests.
We heard from Anna in Janesville, who couldn't stay on the line. She's wondering if there will be an impact on taxpayers if more people are being held in jails on cash bond instead of being released. Is that a possible impact?
Well, the mechanism by which that would happen would be that if we're detaining more people, obviously our jails would then be more full and they would have more capacity constraints. We'd have to think about either expanding them or thinking about alternatives to traditional detention. And certainly that has implications for taxpayers. We're in a time when people are generally across the country trying to think about how to rely less on incarceration, particularly for pretrial populations, people who haven't been convicted of any offense yet. And I think that those kinds of conversations are going to continue, and depending on how much judges choose to impose cash bond, the new law change allows them to do so, but it doesn't require them to do so. However, if we have more people detained, then yes, our counties are going to have difficult conversations about how to make sure that we're detaining people in a way that's humane.
In our last minute and a half or so, Cecilia, we've mentioned a couple times, you know, there's cash bail, but you mentioned there are other conditions that a judge can impose when someone is released and awaiting trial. What are some examples of those kind of conditions that might be put on someone?
So there's a wide range, everything from curfews to limits on locations that people can go. Often there can be limits on people with whom you can interact. So it's very common, for example, to bar people from interacting with co-defendants or with the putative victims of their crimes. Things of that nature. It can include sometimes things like GPS monitoring, restrictions on the consumption of alcohol or other substances, things of that nature.
Briefly, Cecilia, what are you watching for as these constitutional amendments come into practice?
So I'm going to be really interested to see to what degree it actually changes the practice of our magistrate judges in setting bond. Again, as I said earlier, the new changes give judges wider discretion in making decisions about when to impose conditions, what conditions to impose, and whether or not to use cash. But we don't know yet how, if at all, actual practice will be affected by these legal changes.
Cecilia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Cecilia Klingel, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on criminal law, constitutional criminal procedure, sentencing, and corrections. She was with us today to look at how the state constitutional amendments passed last week by voters will change the cash bail system here in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your thoughts, maybe your experiences in that system, at ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin will be the movie capital of the world starting Thursday at the Wisconsin Film Festival. Join Kate and her guests for a preview and learn about the movie scene here in Wisconsin. Maybe find out what you want to see coming up. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you like to go out dancing and you really like to dress up for it, have I got a suit for you? Well, I don't have it. It's up for auction, and it's expected to go for about $200,000. As reported by CNN, one of the white suits worn by John Travolta in the disco-centered film Saturday Night Fever is on the auction block. Now, even if you haven't seen the movie, you'd probably recognize this suit. It's white, three pieces, lots of polyester, big lapels, oversized pockets. This baby's got it all. What size is it? The article doesn't say, so I guess it's, you know, John Travolta size, circa 1977. The movie helped supercharge the rise of disco music and dancing. And if you wear this suit, you can help bring it back. Disco never died. This is Central Time.